You're listening to the Option Alpha podcast from OptionAlpha.com, where we show you how to make smarter trades, learn how the stock market really works, and generate consistent monthly income. Now, your host and head trader at OptionAlpha.com, Kirk Duplessis.
Hey everyone, this is Kirk here again from OptionAlpha.com, working every single week to make this the most popular investing podcast offered online because it's based on one thing and one thing only, and that's helping you guys make smarter trades. So again, thank you so much for tuning in to today's episode. I am super excited to bring two different guests to the podcast today. Kevin Smith and Tavia Costa from Crescat Capital are going to be joining us here in just a little bit. And I want to give you a little bit of background on both of these two guys, tell you a little bit about what they do running the hedge fund over at Crescat. And I think what's really cool about this, and many people who have listened to the show for a long time now, for multiple years we've been running this, know that I'm very protective of bringing on guests to the podcast. So we get a lot of people who want to join the podcast every single week. And some of the stuff is crazy off the wall stuff. I don't even know how they get up enough nerve to kind of just ask if they can join the podcast and be a guest and interviewed for these topics, but they do. And so I'm very protective of the people who I bring on to this podcast that, kind of ultimately get into your ears and, get some of your attention as well. And so I think today's guests are going to more than exceed your expectations as far as just an understanding of how they look at the markets, how they run their hedge fund. It's going to be really cool because we're going to be diving into a bunch of different things, just like some narratives around central banks, U.S. stock valuations, the U.S.-China trade deal, and Chinese stimulus. We're going to be talking about Fed rates and yield curve inversion, sentiment, options trades that they've done before. And I think one of the coolest things that you'll probably take away from this, besides just the macro timing kind of component that we're going to be looking at, is the way that they talk about sticking with conviction using a data-driven approach. So what I don't often see in the hedge fund space, at least I haven't seen it a lot in the hedge fund space, is guys that are like Kevin and Tavi that do a lot of transparency around what they're using generally for, their trading data and what they're looking at, and then how that leads them into making discretionary trades, because they're not totally a quantitative based approach shop. They don't have, models and, indicators that are doing every little entry and exit. They have themes that they're kind of running off of, and that, drives more of what they do than other things. And that's really cool to see kind of this data-driven approach to discretionary trading that we don't get that often. If you do get a chance before the interview or after the interview is done, go on over to crescat.net, which is their website for Crescat Capital. We'll have a link to it in the show notes. So all of this will be detailed in the show notes. You can just head on over to optionalpha.com/show161. Again, that's just the number 161, optionalpha.com/show161. But if you do get over to crescat.net, what I think are two of the most important areas you can check out are the perspectives, not only just the quarterly research letters that they write out to all investors. And this is actually really cool because you don't have to be an investor in the fund to actually get these. So you can just go over there, literally click the button right at the top. And these are very detailed. And what I love about these, and I literally spent time reading back through the historical backlog of these a while back, they're super, super detailed. They go into a lot of detail on what they're looking at, what markets, what cycles, what indicators, what sentiment trends. It's really, really cool to kind of see this thought process. And again, a level of transparency that we're just not used to in the industry. And then the other thing is obviously the current views. So they do a lot of current views and quick little updates here and there on, just kind of rare things that are happening or, major historical timelines, lining up with different things like precious metals or oil at the same time. It's kind of cool to see that. Again, my thought process on all this is you should use this as just another tool in your toolbox. Do you follow everything that everyone says out there? Of course not. But you use this to build a case for yourself and to figure out kind of where your perspectives are. In my case, I wanted to bring these guys on because I don't have necessarily this big macro, model that I use. There's a lot of things that I like to look at, but I don't have a specific set of parameters that I look at. And I've been, diving deeper and deeper into this, kind of idea of getting a better understanding of macro indicators and macro timing models. And so it was, self-fulfilling for me to get these guys on and start asking about this. So as we join these guys here in just a couple seconds, a couple things you need to know about who they are. One, they've had a really, really good performance and track record. So actually last year in 2018, they were the number one performing macro hedge fund by Barclay Hedge. And that's saying something because 2018 was not the best year for the S&P 500. And yet they did really well. You can read all their awards on the website. It probably takes too long to do it, but there's a lot of awards. They continue to outperform outperform most of the hedge funds in the industry, if not all the hedge funds in their space, which is really, really cool to see that happen. As far as the team goes, Kevin, who's going to be joining us, he is the founder and CIO of Crescat. He's been in the industry 26 years, CFA holder. He's basically been with all the strategies since their inception, runs a lot of the processes and the advisory boards for Crescat. And then Tavi is going to be joining us. He's a global macro analyst for them. He's the one who basically built out their new macro timing model that they basically released a little bit ago, originally from Brazil, speaks Spanish, Portuguese, and English, which is way better than me because I barely have mastered English, my wife tells me. But what was cool about Tavi is, again, his underwriting of all these products and international business is definitely a big help for their fund. So without further ado, let's get these guys on the phone and get right into the interview. All right. So I have Kevin and Tavi on the phone. Guys, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you guys so much for joining. I really appreciate it. And so I want to start off with this first question. And I think this is probably the most important question that I know everyone wants to hear the answer to, myself included. You guys are located in Denver, so please tell me you're Bronco fans.
Of course we are.
He is.
Okay. Well, I know, Tavi, I know you're from Brazil originally, so American football might be a little bit different than US football, but as a huge Bronco fan, that's a big driver for me is obviously getting other Bronco fans on the podcast and hearing what they have to say because they know more than everybody else, obviously. Okay.
Oh, I definitely watch it.
How could you not, right? Exactly.
Yeah, right.
Okay, cool. All right. So now, in all seriousness, kind of getting that aside, what I mentioned in the original intro to the show and what I'll reiterate now is what I love about what you guys do and the research you guys put out and just kind of your transparency on how you look at the world and how you invest is that it's a lot of a very much a data-driven approach to being discretionary. So you guys obviously take discretionary positions. There's not a huge like quant. You're only doing quant-based strategies, if I'm understanding it correctly, but you have a lot of data to kind of back up your convictions. And one of the things I think is really cool and I wanted to kind of start off with is this whole macro model that you guys developed, because from the way that I can see it on the research and all the writings that you guys have done over the past couple of years, is that's a real big component to how you look at timing and valuation and really these flawed narratives that are driving the market right now.
Absolutely. I guess I'll take that. So it's a 16-factor macro model that includes macro indicators and fundamental factors, key valuation factors, and a few other technicals too. And it's, you know, the idea is just a real simple model. It's not very complex by any means. And if you look back in history with the score of this model, which is an equal weighted model, you can see that every time the score of this model goes above the 85th percentile on this rank, we saw that we're at the peak of the cycle. We've seen this, it timed really well the last two business cycles, the peaks and the bottoms. And this model really started to show us that we're at the record overvalue levels, or at least at a more late stage of the cycle, in September of 2015. And this was at the time when emerging markets were blowing up and you had energy and oil prices declining significantly. At the same time, as close to December was when we had that market correction in the S&P 500, which got kind of paused by the Fed that paused its rate hike cycle and kind of extended the business cycle again. But right now we're, you know, this is, the bubble just got more frothy and we see several or multiple macro signs that they're showing us that we're, you know, very overdue for something here. And, you know, not, you know, aside from inversions and yield curve and other things. But the idea of the model is just how to quantify several factors that have worked in the past and have a really high correlation with the changes in the business cycle, and how to, you know, some factors worked in the past, some others don't work. But if you can add them all together at one and have one score, you know, how does that look like throughout history? And, you know, today we're only 2 percentage points away from record overvalue levels. And it kind of drives our views about the world and about the US markets in general.
Yeah, I think what's cool about it, as far as I understand it, is, you know, many people that have had, and why I asked you guys to be on the show and to be on the podcast, is that I hear people all the time saying, you know, the market's over, you know, PE ratios are here and CAPE ratios are here. And oh, that doesn't matter because, you know, interest rates are low, which we know is not really the case, right? Like there could be an argument that PE ratios are still pretty, you know, like pretty overvalued regardless of interest rates. But I haven't seen anybody yet that's kind of brought a lot of these things together and said, let's look at the 10,000 foot view, right? That, you know, there's a lot of things at play here. It's not just one, you know, factor in a silo or in a, you know, vacuum. And there's a lot of other things. So the three things though, that I think, you guys have identified as being flawed narratives are central banks, stock, U.S. stock valuations, and then China. So maybe you guys want to dive into those or kind of talk about those briefly as maybe being your three catalysts or your themes that you call them of how you see the world right now.
Sure. So they're each kind of three big things in and of themselves. One of the big ones that I'll talk about is really the central bank narrative and the idea that central banks have your back. And you know, we are record late in the business cycle in terms of this being the longest U.S. expansion that we've ever had. And the Fed has been raising interest rates late in the business cycle, which is what you tend to see near the end of every business cycle. And going from 0% to 240 basis points on the Fed funds rate is actually the biggest rate increase late in the business cycle that we've ever seen on a rate of change basis. And rate of change of Fed funds interest rate hiking in the last 2 years is actually one of the factors in our 16-factor macro model. But what you see today is actually that global central bank liquidity in terms of global central bank assets as N or M0, as well as global M2, or the whole money supply, when you add together all of the big central banks of the world, has actually been in contraction over the past year. And that's very unusual, but because the Fed's been in QT, M2 has been shrinking globally, we actually have liquidity drying up. And that's a bearish signal currently. But a lot of people think, well, central banks have your back, they're pausing here, and they're going to go back to QE if they need to. Well, even in 07 and 08, when global central banks were printing $3 to $4 trillion worth of money, you know, all that money printing didn't prevent the market from crashing. It only precipitated and coincided with it. You know, even when the Fed finally came into the rescue with its QE1. So really, you know, there is a business cycle, and with stocks at record valuations, you know, normally the Fed only comes to the rescue when things are really bad. And that's, you know, things have to get bad first. And that, you know, that's the global economic downturn that we see coming.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, it's interesting because I hear from traders and people saying, well, you know, if anything ever happens, the Fed will just cut rates again, you know, like you said. And that seems to be the narrative. But what you guys had mentioned, I'm quoting you from one of the pieces you wrote, which I thought was great. You said it's important to note that stock market peaks associated with the last 9 recessions occurred on average 2 months before the last Fed rate hike. And none of these historical corrections and bear markets surrounded late cycle Fed reversals bottomed until after the economy entered a recession. And so this is kind of where we're at here. It's like, you know, this late cycle Fed rate hike, now they're pausing, you know, which to me seems like they're worried about something, because why would they pause rate hikes if everything was, you know, very good and, you know, blue skies ahead? Do you guys agree or do you see it differently?
Absolutely. You can also see that, you know, sort of relationship by looking at the 2-year yields. The 2-year yields are very interesting. It's a very simple way of looking at the world, you know, or the US mostly, and seeing how credit markets are starting to price in significantly that the Fed's going to start easing sometime soon. Right now we have the work or the probability of the Fed hike cutting rates to close to 80% right now. And usually that's an acknowledgement that, you know, of weakness in the economy in general.
Right.
But what's interesting about the 2-year yields is that if you looked at the 2-year yields on a log version all the way back to the 70s and 80s, and you just connect the tops of the 2-year yields, every time it reaches that and hits that resistance line and starts falling significantly, that has also coincided with recessions and bear markets, like the double dip recession and the tech bubble and also the global financial crisis. We're seeing that again today, you know, but not just that, but we also have record valuations. So, you know, that's always the sort of argument is that, you know, the Fed is going to cut rates and things are going to go back to normal. Or the Fed is going to, or the global central banks are going to be printing money, and that's going to prevent a collapse. But people forget they have a very short-term memory that, you know, like Kevin was mentioning, in the global financial crisis in early 06 or so, even before the Fed, the first QE in the Federal Reserve that imposed was, you know, it was close to $2 to $3 trillion of money printing that did not prevent the market from collapsing.
Right. Yeah.
Same goes for interest rates. You know, that chart that you were alluding to, you know, it's exactly that. It's when they cut rates is when they're sort of in a desperate mode.
Yeah. And I think it's kind of playing catch up. You know, it seems like, and even reading, you know, other research from like Ray Dalio, what he put out with his like bubble paper that he put out, you know, it's kind of interesting that, you know, the Fed usually, or central banks in general, try to play catch up, right? They try to undercut the market just as it's falling, but sometimes it's too little too late. I think on the yield curve inversion, I know you guys had mentioned, and I thought this was interesting too, because a lot of people will say, well, the yield curve inverting is not really that important, or this, you know, spread inverting is not really that important. But what you guys had looked at is kind of a compilation of all of these different possible spreads and trying to figure out, okay, how many of these different spreads are actually inverted?
So yeah, we looked at the 44 possible spreads in the US yield curve. We also done this, you know, across the globe with other countries. But the interesting part is that right now it's close to 55% of the yield curve in the US is inverted, and it bounces around. It got close to 60 or above 60% at some point, and below 50, you know, in the last few weeks. And so it bounces around quite a lot, just like others as well. But what tells you is that, yeah, sure, yield curve inversions in the US, they may take 1 to 2 years to play out in a, you know, in a bear market to manifest itself. But actually in the tech bubble, you know, it would actually coincide. You know, the levels that we have of percentage of inversions in the yield curve, when we had close to 55%, it actually coincide perfectly with the peak of the S&P 500 back in those days. And so we've had a lot of other times that, you know, the market peaks that coincide with inversions. And I think people focus a lot on this, which we think it's kind of almost like an outlier, really. Oh, wait, you know, with taking 1 to 2 years until, you know, the 2 versus 10s inverted in 06, 05 or so, 06 or so. And it took another 1 or 2 years until inverted, until the market started to collapse. And that, you know, I think people rely so much on that argument, and it doesn't make a lot of sense, especially with all these other signs. And as I said, this is a global phenomenon, and places like Hong Kong, you know, a huge financial hub worldwide, now close to, you know, 85% of its yield curve is inverted today. Canada is close to 60%. So, you know, you're really starting to see some real cracks here in the world economy, that we should see some sell-off, some significant sell-off in equity markets, we think, pretty soon here.
Yeah, well, I think we're already starting to see it even this last couple of weeks, which I'm sure is making you guys happy, given your positions. But I think that it's funny, you know, like on my end, I'm a probability and kind of like numbers trader. And so, you know, if I trade the probabilities, I tell people all the time, like, we could obviously see something way outside of the expected range, but that doesn't mean that that becomes the new standard. And so, like what you said with the inversion in the last cycle, or like lack of inversion kind of happening right before the market turned over, you know, people look at that and they're like, aha, like I told you there was one instance where it didn't happen, and now that becomes the standard rule. Versus just looking at it, you know, kind of holistically, like what's likely to happen more often than not, right? So switching gears here just a little bit, maybe let's talk about two different things, which I think are interesting. Corporate debt, people talk about all the time. We know that companies have been levering up like crazy. And you guys had mentioned 80% of Canadian banks, or at least Canadian stocks, maybe correct me, and then 60% of companies in the US are generating negative free cash flow. So we have all this debt, and we have companies that are, you know, conceivably not even making money. You know, that again is another potential sign of like, hey, we're at the later stages of this cycle where, you know, if we continue growth, we have to at some point have companies that make money. Is that correct assumption? Or,
well, yes. And if you think about all of the record global central bank liquidity that's been generated in the last, over this cycle, to still have so many companies that can't even make money is just unbelievable. And now we have record levels of corporate debt. So yeah, what normally happens is that we have, you know, when we get into a business cycle downturn, is we've been having all these stock buybacks, which now are record highs, but, you know, the companies start hoarding their cash that they have when you get into a real downturn. Like back in 2007, we had record stock buybacks for that cycle. Mm-hmm. And then 2008 hit, when companies should have been buying back their stock, when the stocks actually got cheap, stock buybacks were nowhere to be found. So companies have been taking on debt to buy back stock. And in this cycle, but many companies don't even have the free cash flow, you know, to fund their ongoing business operations. And look at all the IPOs of companies that, you know, Uber and Lyft and et cetera, that are not generating positive free cash flow. And everyone thinks that all these disruptor companies are going to be the next Amazon out there. But like Warren Buffett says, when the tide goes out, you're going to find out who's swimming naked,
right?
Or whatever. So
yeah, you know, no, I think
still to reckon with.
Yeah, I think it's amazing. I mean, I think, I don't know, you know, how people look at it nowadays. But I think eventually, you know, a fundamental valuation has to come back into play at some point. You can't project growth at such alarming rates so far out into the future, because it's just unreasonable at some point. You know, it becomes unreasonable to expect, you know, such high projections. But who knows? I mean, that's how people, I guess, are still, you know, buying into this, although not as much as before. So when we talk about, I guess, you know, talking about market sentiment, you guys have done a little bit on this and have posted about market sentiment and, you know, the differences in kind of these peaks and troughs between dumb money, smart money, how, you know, consumer sentiment is positioned. I thought an interesting one, particularly since I trade options and trade volatility, as you said, VIX speculation is at an extreme. Speculative VIX traders are more net short stock market volatility than they were at the September peak. And this was just last quarter, a couple quarters ago in your note. So maybe you could talk a little bit about how sentiment plays into it, particularly for your models, and then how you look at sentiment. Is, you know, great sentiment good? Is great sentiment bad? How do you guys look at it?
Yeah, well, normally with sentiment, you know, if you're a momentum trader, you want to be on the same side of the sentiment. But one thing that we like to look at is when sentiment is at an extreme in one direction or not, because that's when you tend to get the big inflection points, the tops and the bottoms that become tradable events. And it was about just, I think, maybe 2 weeks ago that we saw some of these extreme sentiment indicators lining up again, much the way they were, maybe it was 4 weeks ago, at much the way they were both before Volmageddon back in February of 2018, and again before the market sell-off that we had in the fourth quarter. Just extreme bullish sentiment across any number of different indicators. The one that we featured was the VIX futures record speculative net short. And that one played out really well ahead of the fourth quarter downturn. It was also record net short ahead of what we call Volmageddon, that when the volatility ETFs blew up in February of 2018. And that one took a little bit longer to play out before we had the February sell-off. But there was also a similar VIX record net short ahead of that one.
Yeah. Another thing of sentiment as well, if you look at consumer expectation in general, consumer confidence, there are two ways to look at the future expectation and the present situation. And when you start seeing the future expectation starts to fall versus the present situation, it tends to be a very negative sign. And so when the spread between these two consumer confidence indices offered by the Conference Board, the number in, when you start to see the spread turn negative in a big way, every time, it's kind of an uncanny relationship. Every time that happened, it led to a recession. And we're seeing that again today. And it's just starting to actually move a little bit more, you know, to narrowing the spread a little bit. So it's a really great indicator for recessions in general, all the way back to the 70s. And we're seeing that again today. Just like Kevin said, it's an extreme confidence among consumers. You know, it tends to be great every time at the peak of a cycle as well.
Yeah. And I think what it kind of gets into is, you know, what we have right now is this perfect economy. And in fact, I think you guys actually mentioned perfect economy in one of your Q3 2017 writings. You said we have this, you know, full unemployment, low rates, low inflation, at least for now. You know, corporate earnings are doing well. So what could possibly go wrong? But this is actually, I think it was in your guys' chart, and I'll post a link to it in the show notes, that only one other time in history did we have such a perfect setup, and it was right before the 29 crash, right? So we have amazing confidence. We have all of the, you know, Goldilocks type of, you know, scenarios playing out, but ultimately it's actually not the best time to be invested in at least US equities, right?
When it's as good as it gets, it's as good as it gets, and it can only get worse. You know,
especially when it's linked to high valuations. And I think that chart you're talking about is the one, low inflation, low unemployment. But I guess a nominal GDP growth was, you know, between the 2 to 3% or so forth.
Yep.
Kind of your standard
high earnings growth.
Yeah, with lots of high earnings growth and everything is perfect, but add high valuations. And, you know, when you look back in history, it's exactly right. It's 1929 was the last time we had a very similar macro scenario.
Right. So, okay. So this leads to the next major question, which is, okay, all of this stuff sounds pretty gloomy and doomy, right? And I know you guys are not only short, you guys take long positions, and you guys, I'm sure, would get insanely long the markets if the roles were reversed on all these indicators, right? So now the question is, okay, what are the issues that we're not thinking about? Like, what are the things that can derail the timing of this, that are things that, you know, if the Fed does this, that that could, you know, restructure it. And things that I like come to mind are obviously China maybe could, you know, keep printing or do something and hold out longer than people imagine with this trade war, or the Fed could drop rates quickly and that could maybe, you know, fend off another couple of months. But when you guys think about this, what are the things that you're looking at as being potential issues with how you see all of this playing out, or things that might change your opinion?
Sure. We're always looking for what could go wrong with our views, our basic positioning, and we're trying to use our models first and foremost to guide us in that and let our models tell us where we're wrong. And I mean, because just being wrong in terms of securities positions going against you is not necessarily something that we want to stop out of. So we use risk model to contain our overall risk. And sometimes we have to trim positions that are not working in our favor, but we like to really stay positioned according to what our models are telling us we should be doing. And the risk model helps us do that. But in terms of what could go wrong, I mean, yeah, you know, one of the big narratives, like we talked about already, is that the Fed has got your back. The Fed could come in, drop interest rates, and really pump things up even more speculatively than they are now. One of the long positions that we have to really, that we think is the perfect hedge for that scenario is our long precious metals positions. And we are, precious metals are record cheap today relative to the global fiat monetary base. So in the long run, as global central banks print money, gold tends to follow that money printing in a rising fashion. And it was doing it from 2006 all the way to about 2012. And then it started to diverge because all the printed money out there was not really going to create inflation. And so we had this negative real interest rate environment along with all this money printing where gold was on fire from 2006 to 2012. But then we've been in a 7-year bear market now for precious metals since that time, because it never translated into any real inflation, even as global central banks kept printing money, QE2, QE3, and so forth, and the Japan and the ECB. And so gold is really, you know, coiled up. But what we've seen recently, now that the Fed has signaled that it's going to pause in global credit markets, or the U.S. credit markets at least are signaling that the Fed's more likely to ease in the next year, 80% probability than tighten, we have real interest rates starting to drop again. And that's kind of the catalyst here to get precious metals going. But if the Fed does all of a sudden come in with a surprise interest rate drop or go back to QE, you know, before, you know, our views have really taken hold in terms of the equity downturn, we think they're not going to come in like that until we get a big downturn first. But let's just say that they do. And, you know, we think gold is and silver, which is even cheaper relative to gold, are going to really take off. So we have a number of long positions in precious metals, mining stocks and precious metals themselves, and including options on gold and silver futures, et cetera.
Yeah, that's all. And I think it's, you know, the gold, I've heard you guys talk about the gold story before and write about it. And I think it's highly fascinating, one, because nobody talks about gold anymore. I mean, if the conversation goes to, even gets close to, you know, something that's a hedge for inflation or central banks, it immediately goes to, in this case, lately, cryptocurrencies or something else. But I don't think anybody talks about gold. And I know that, you know, a lot of central banks are still accumulating gold, right? They're not divesting from it. They're starting to accumulate it at higher and higher paces. So if we get into more, you know, currency wars between, you know, countries, who's devaluing what against, you know, what other currency pair or basket, I think there's obviously a strong case that gold could be the intermediary, at least for the time being, right?
That's correct. And go ahead, Tavi, you were going to say something.
Well, no, just not to mention the fact that, you know, given all those issues we're seeing today in the macro setup worldwide, you know, you have gold implied volatility being at one of its lowest levels in history, which makes absolutely no sense, where things like the Russell 3000, sort of the broad stocks in the US here kind of index relative to silver being, you know, near all-time highs. You know, it reached all-time highs recently, kind of retesting the 2000 extreme valuations versus silver. And, you know, you think about that, you know, silver is your high beta version of gold. How, you know, that makes no sense, you know, being this late in the cycle and having silver prices being this depressed. So, you know, even, you know, the links with the two-year yields that I was talking about. The two-year yields are nominal rates when they drop. If they are going to drop significantly, you would expect real yields to drop along with it. And, you know, historically tends to be very positive for precious metals too. Inversions, all the yield curve inversions. Look at yield curve inversions. Every time yield curve inversions happen, it tends to be very positive for gold relative to the S&P 500 ratio. So all the signs are, you know, I don't think we've been this excited about gold in a long time. We've always had this or understood this kind of a gold bug mentality of, you know, excessive debt and leveraging the system globally would sometime would lead to a value destruction of global fiat currencies. But, you know, but the question is when. But now we're seeing all the signs and, you know, in precious metals and markets, and that makes us be very and see tremendous value in precious metals in general.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think what's cool about this, like I said in the beginning, is that, you know, and personally too, like I've, you know, thought like this can't be good, right? Like this can't end well, you know, all the printing and all this and, you know, corporate debt levels. But the problem has always been, you know, when is the time? You know, when is it actually, because it's gone on for so long. And what I like about what you guys do, especially with your macro model, is, you know, using percentiles and, you know, how you kind of boil it down to, you know, one kind of metric that we can use and look at. And then, you know, use that saying like, okay, well, this could be the time, right? We could start transitioning out of, you know, US equities and start transitioning into gold. And, you know, for us and for the people who listen to this podcast, like we're shorter duration traders. Like I don't have major positions that I'm holding for 5 years, right? But it's helpful for me to know, you know, what kind of those indicators and those model timings are showing so that I can appropriately prepare, you know, because it could happen this month or it could happen in the next 3 months. But at least I know what's kind of coming on the horizon. So two other kind of topics I want to talk about before we wrap up. Obviously, we trade options here at Option Alpha, so that shouldn't come as a surprise. I know you guys have said before that you guys in Q3, you guys had talked about shorting the Chinese yuan through put options. You specifically said laddered out in different durations. And then in your Q4, you also talked about XLU put options and HYG, JNK. So you guys do a decent amount. I don't know, actually. I'm actually truly asking, how much of your portfolio, I guess, do you guys use option contracts as leverage? And I'd be super curious to know how you look at using options in conjunction with your long short or long only funds.
Sure. Well, you mentioned several of the option trades that we have on now that are long vol type option positions. We have a few short option plays as well on things like pot stocks, where the Canadian cannabis stocks, where the implied vol is excessive and the borrowing cost is excessive to just outright short them. And so by shorting the in the money calls, you can actually get exposure where you, instead of having to pay to short a stock, you can actually get paid to short a stock. And that's been pretty successful for us too. But mostly because of the low volatility environment that we're in for equities and for corporate credit, you know, we're using, and also with the utility short that we have, we're using long put options to express our bearish views on those things.
And then, so the question that I have is, why choosing different durations? So when you would build a position, are you going, and you don't have, I don't know if you can disclose this or not, but are you going out, you know, 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, and choosing different durations that way? Or what's the process behind actually choosing, I guess, the contracts and even the strikes? Are you buying in the money or out of the money, you know, deep out of the money? What's the process behind that?
Sure. It kind of depends on how much exposure we want to get within the bounds of our views and our risk model. And we have an option trade worksheet that we use to kind of size the positions, whether we're looking to get, you know, more delta notional exposure relative to the amount of premium that we put at risk. And that, you know, it's a little bit of a creative process in terms of, you know,
it always is.
Position. Yep. A little bit of experimenting with how much risk to move. Premium do we want to risk to get this amount of delta notional exposure? But normally we're not going too far out of the money. We'll go a little bit out of the money, sometimes we'll go in the money, but normally we're looking for our views to play out, you know, over the next 3 to 6 months. And so normally we'll start with something kind of in that range for duration and be willing to roll it over if it doesn't play out and we still believe in that position.
Gotcha. Wonderful. All right. So last question here, and I think this one is going to be interesting because I know, like, I think this question just kind of circles in the investing community and, you know, whether people ask it directly or whether they think about it intuitively. But, you know, you guys have continued to outperform both the S&P and the global hedge fund index. But I assume that this year, because of just the recent rally that we have and your guys' positions, probably hasn't been like amazing performance to this date, at least until May when you guys have your performance listed. So when you're talking with clients and you're talking with, you know, people, what, I guess, are the things that kind of give you guys enough of, you know, courage and vigilance to stay consistent with the themes? Because, you know, it seems to be that a lot of investors quickly change their assumptions, you know, and that's a hard thing to do, is to stick with an assumption or a theme or, you know, view on the world and to not deviate from that if you know it's going to be right, and to go through these gyrations and kind of ups and downs in the process to getting there. So maybe how do you guys kind of overcome that? I know it's tough as managers because you guys are under a lot of scrutiny. You guys probably have clients calling in when things are good and things are bad, I'm sure. But how do you guys kind of, you know, stick with, you know, the framework and the roadmap of where you guys are going?
Well, I think our approach more recently has been to provide, you know, really good research, quality content that proves our thesis and validates on a daily basis if we're right or wrong about our thesis. And prices can go to different directions for the wrong reasons and for a long time and or for medium term time here. And it's, you know, it's kind of in our view what's happening right now. We see this, you know, the communication with clients is, I think it's challenging for anybody when you're not performing, but you have to be grounded. You have to be, you know, really make sure that the models that you look at are still supporting the thesis. The overall idea is still correct, that we're not, you know, there's no flaws in our arguments and in a big way. And I think that we're, you know, we're continuing to see tremendous opportunities out there on the short side of markets. And as you mentioned a little bit earlier, you know, with the recent sell-off in stocks in general, we're starting to see our portfolio performing really well here in the last few days. And that helps quite a lot on our confidence too. But I think that research and, you know, validating your thesis is a ongoing process, and it's a huge part of communicating with clients. I think this time, and Kevin can maybe talk more about this, but I think this time we've done a better job at communicating with people in general about our thesis, even though it hasn't been working for 1 or 2 or 3 months, whatever that is. You know, we've had a really big year in 2018. And the reason for that was because, you know, we stuck with our positions from the 2017. And we thought that, you know, the market was really frothy for so many reasons and started really dive into more of the macro part of the research, not so much. And, you know, obviously the fundamental research was there. We knew that markets are overvalued in so many ways, different ways you could look at. But, you know, overlaying that macro research was critical for us to not just to communicate, but also to make sure that the thesis was still in place. And I, you know, we think that back in 2018, it was kind of similar. The beginning of the year didn't work well for us, actually. It started off, you know, in the wrong way, and then things turned it around. So I think sticking with your plan, if you have a good plan, is better than panicking and, you know, and just trying to move the direction of the markets in general.
Yeah, we are different, I think, from a lot of traders who might be more technical. We use technical analysis on the edges, but we are predominantly, you know, committed to our fundamental and macro models, and those keep us positioned. And then we use the risk model to overall to contain our exposure and be able to ride through pullbacks. And yeah, you're right. We had a pullback year to date. However, we're coming back strong here now in May. And, you know, throughout it all, we've just stayed committed to our models and our basic themes that those models are driving. You said something earlier, Kirk, that was, I think, really important. And that is that when we're late in the cycle, we don't, and then the Fed pauses and the recession comes an average of 5 months after that we don't see the bottom of the bear market until it's actually been acknowledged that we've had a recession. And we're either in the bottom, usually happens in the middle of that recession, or sometime after. And so a lot of people, I think, thought that 20% correction that we had in December, that was it. That was the correction. That was the bear market, and it's all over, you know. So it's been surprising to us that we came all the way back up to retest and to even push a little bit higher in the S&P. But we think it's a triple top, basically, that we reached in here recently a few weeks ago. And there's a big broken trend line that all we've done is come up and retest the bottom of that trend line from a technical standpoint. And now it's started to fail again.
Yeah.
So we think, the recession, the bear market, it's all still coming in the fourth quarter. That was just a glimpse of what's more to play out here still.
That was the preview. Yeah. Like I said, and I am not taking anything away from you guys. You guys obviously have had stellar performance and you've had a really good track record of, kind of picking and choosing these. This isn't your first rodeo in kind of shorting markets. I know you guys, shorted and played the housing collapse very well. I know the oil collapse very well, as well as a number of others. What's cool, I think, about this, and my wife will attest to this because I spent the last like 4 days prepping for, jumping on with you guys. Me, I read everything. I listened to all the interviews on Bloomberg and all this stuff. I think what's cool is that you guys stay very much on narrative, on point. You're very convicted in, like what you think, your models are showing. And that's hard to find. I think that's hard to find, somebody who, and even in my world in trading, people can get thrown back and forth between, trades very quickly. And one of the things you guys actually said, which I thought was amazing, was that you can never be right on all your themes. And when you're wrong, you're happy to recognize it, but it's not about the short-term losses. It's about the long-term view that you guys basically take, that basically this long-term value of the portfolio will play out, but it may take some time and you're going to go through some ups and downs. And I think having people hear what you guys say about, having that happen on a hedge fund level is really important, because many people think, oh, I have a drawback of, 2%, like that's it, I'm done. This thing doesn't work and it's broken and nothing works and I should quit. But it's not the case, right? We can't always work in a straight line 100% of the time.
Right. Yeah. I mean, we do believe in taking a moderate amount of risk, and it's really necessary as a value-oriented macro manager. Value is important to us and we rely on it to be able to hang with our views. So that's what gives us comfort even when things aren't working, is that the value of our portfolio at any one time, at least according to our models and our conviction, is substantially more than the market might be pricing in. And so we're willing to ride through those pullbacks to see it to fruition, the value to fruition. And that's kind of how we view the world.
Great. Well, guys, thank you so much for being on here. I really do appreciate it. It's been super interesting, and I encourage everyone to check out your guys' site over at Crescat Capital, crescat.net. Where else can people find you? Are you guys active on social media, or how can they get in touch if they want to learn more information about your guys' funds or what you guys do?
Well, we're very active on social media, no doubt. Mine is at Tavi Costa, my Twitter handle, Kevin.
And my Twitter handle is at Crescat Kevin.
Yep. Website.
We're also on LinkedIn, pretty active there. And Tavi recently has been doing a new series of videos on YouTube, which people can check out.
And our website, crescat.net, as well, is where we post most of our letters and research and a lot of the things we posted on social media also there as well, videos people and interviews.
People can sign up for our newsletter, which we put out quarterly and actually monthly even. We have updates monthly. So you can just go to our website and sign up there, or send an email to info@crescat.net if you want any further information.
Yeah, that's awesome. And just full disclosure, I signed up for the newsletter. I'm reading all the stuff. I'm getting the updates as they come in. So I went back through the entire history and read it over the weekend. So it's really good. It's well put together research, and it's definitely not fluff. It's really good stuff. So you guys are doing an amazing job. Like I said, thank you guys so much for being on the podcast. Really, really appreciate it. It's truly humbling. So thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Kirk.
We're glad to be here. Thank you.
All right. So I hope you guys truly enjoyed today's episode and our interview with Kevin and Tavi. As always, if you have any questions, you can head on over to optionalpha.com/show161. We'll make sure we get all those questions answered in the comment section. You can also check out the show notes there before you get going. As always, if you got one thing out of it and you can apply right now to make you a smarter, more profitable trader and investor, that is our goal here at Option Alpha. Like I said, you can get additional resources, all the links to Crescat and all the research that they do, by going to optionalpha.com/show161. Again, that's just the number 161, optionalpha.com/show161. And of course, if you found this show helpful, if it was enlightening, if you got something out of it, please share Option Alpha, share this podcast with your friends, your family, your coworkers, your brother, your mother, your sister, your wife, your spouse, your whoever, to get the podcast into the hands of more people like you. We would really appreciate it. So until next time, happy trading.
Thanks for listening to the Option Alpha podcast. If you liked what you heard, please drop by iTunes and leave a rating or comment. Plus, you can get everything. Free email updates for future shows, transcripts, video tutorials, case studies, and more. Just visit our website at optionalpha.com.